Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Join us for a journey as we go back to the great civilizations of the past. Who were the people? What were they like? How did they begin? And how did they end? Let's find out on this episode of Fan of History.
We have the chief eunuchs, Rab Sareft. There are several chief eunuchs because there are several groups of eunuchs. One at King's Court, one at the Court of the Crown Prince, and probably in the other courts as well.
Mm-hmm.
But these two chief eunuchs are on this level. And of course, the chief eunuch of the King's Court is the most important.
Right.
But the amount of eunuchs in the Assyrian system is quite impressive.
Yeah.
And then we get to the next guy at the vizier level. And he is the chief justice.
Huh.
The Sartenu. And he's not anywhere near like the head judge of the country. But he is involved in legal matters. And he can also show up on the eponym lists.
Okay. Is he like attorney general, maybe?
Maybe we can make a whole episode about the legal system because it's really different from today. But this guy is important for the justice system. And the English translation of his title is the chief justice.
Okay.
But we'll move on the vizier level to the majors of cities.
All right.
So the major of Nineveh, he is lower than the governor of Nineveh, but he is on the level of the viziers and the chief justice.
All right.
So the governor's jurisdiction moves outside of the city, but the major's does not.
Oh, okay.
We also have to return to people at the court who are as powerful as the chief justice and the viziers. And this position is fantastic. We have the Rab Nuhatime,
oof,
the chief baker. There are also Rab Nuhatimes at other courts as well, but this is the king's chief baker. He is actually responsible for feeding and taking care of everyone at the court.
Yeah, that's a big job.
Yes.
He reminds me of in the Disney, he's like a chubby guy with a mustache and a French accent, right?
Yes. The Assyrians actually went to France and got people from... No, they didn't.
I am the chief baker. Sorry about that, guys.
Yes, if you have seen the musical Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, there's a very good chief baker in that.
Oh, my daughter just saw it. She came in to tell me about it.
Okay, ask her about the chief baker.
I will.
Okay, I told you this level was huge, and we have a large group of people who are doing a very important service for the country, which makes them as important as viziers. And these are the tax collectors.
Oh, yeah.
And land for taxation is basically split in two groups of lands. The lands controlled by the crown, which is all lands, but then, of course, in the provinces, the governor gets to control it. So that's the difference. Direct control by the crown or in the provinces.
Yeah, so the tax collectors work for the crown. See, that's a different way than the others.
And they don't work for the governor.
Yeah. Or sometimes they were just, hey, you want to get here's a good job. We'll make you the tax collector. That's like a reward because you could take everybody's money.
Yes. And if you're the governor and the king's tax collector arrives, you better have the taxes ready.
Oh, right. He works for the government. Oh, okay.
And here's an exception in the pyramid because no one can command the tax collectors except the king.
Right.
Or perhaps the crown prince.
Yeah. But still, it's centrally controlled. That's not.
So if the grand vizier or someone tries to tell the tax collector something, they will ignore it because they want to go out to collect the king's money.
Yeah. You definitely get in trouble for taking that. I mean, it's sort of mafia-like, but it's also very business-like.
They are probably also involved in the intelligence service.
Oh, for sure. Everybody will. Well, for the good kings, everybody should be. I think that's why, like, as the empire got older and the people that weren't, and that didn't know those how to run the intelligence services, that's why it ended up getting in trouble.
The intelligence service probably cared a lot about the money as well.
You better believe it.
We are still not finished with the vizier level. There are more people here, and these officials are extremely Assyrian. We talked about them as early as in the time of Tukulti-Ninurta II and the invention of cavalry.
Who's these guys?
There is no English name for them. They are the Mularkisu. The best English translation is the horse collectors.
Oh, the horse collectors. All right.
Yes. They are working at this level of the government. They are very powerful guys, and they are getting horses for the army.
Hmm.
They have special rights. They work in pairs or even in small groups sometimes. They go out and make sure that the Assyrian army have horses. This is also something that people high in the pyramid really care about. The Assyrians have to have their horses. They are as important as arrows.
Sure. No kidding. The tanks, they're the backbone. It's not like you have a factory per se. If you're making tanks, you can make sure your factory's going. They got a lot of horses from a lot of different places. That's amazing. I'm sorry. I'm just amazed at all this organization.
And at this level as well, we start to get purely military people. So yeah. The army captains, the Rab Kisri, and the charioteers show up at this level. So if you are anyone that actually rides a chariot in battle, you are at this level. Even if you are the shield bearer on the chariot, you are at this level.
Now that I read that they were kind of ethnically heartland Assyrians that were in the charioteer corps.
That makes sense.
Yeah. They were the core, you were Assyrian from the heartland, and the cavalry, though, the cavalry was not necessarily that, but the chariot corps was a core,
We must remember, this is a very efficient army. I listen a lot to the Ancient Warfare podcast, and they have pretty much debunked chariot warfare.
Yeah.
The chariots are for show, they are to intimidate, but they work quite poorly in a real battle.
Yeah.
So what the charioteers do is that they do like ranger missions. They do military operations that are of a special, delicate nature.
Yep.
And they are very trusted. That's probably why they need to be Assyrians then.
I think of it like, I always try to, you know, get analogies. I think of it like, even today, you might say like, you know, some piece of military equipment wouldn't be great in a big full-on major power war. You know, say, the highest technology, you can wipe them all out. We need soldiers. But when you're controlling a population that doesn't have them, they're quite effective. So like if you were, you know, you had a town, peasants or just people in a town, they don't have chariots and that kind of thing. And you come riding in with a 2 or 3 horse chariot, would, you know, that's, you know, just imagine just like an armored car, you know, in a war today, you get destroyed instantly. But an armored car in a city is quite a weapon.
Also, remember that king and high officials, they get transported by chariots.
Yeah, that too.
So these are important people for doing taxi service for higher officials.
And these soldiers are training all the time. So, I mean, these are your really badass guys to be bodyguards.
And I'm not sure, but most chariots had a 3-person crew. And it seems that the status of the bowman on the chariot, the guy actually firing the arrows, is somewhat less and easily replaced by any archer from the Assyrian army.
Ah.
So it is the shield bearer and the driver that is most important.
Yes. And if you're driving the king, you better be a trusted person.
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
We have one final position at the vizier level. And this is a very mysterious position because we don't know what this person did, but it was always a woman.
Huh.
Iakintu.
Kintu.
She has some sort of position or function. We don't know what it is, but what we can deduce is that she is an eminent individual with substantial wealth.
Hmm.
And that's all we know about her.
Maybe it was a ceremonial position.
Could be.
Yeah.
That's the end of the vizier level. We have to move another level down in the pyramid. At the next level, we have the scribes.
Oh, for sure. Everybody has a scribe.
Yeah, because writing was so difficult.
Yeah.
And you can almost lift out a separate pyramid of scribes.
I'm sure.
So the highest scribe is the vice chancellor, the Umanu, which we discovered much higher in the pyramid because he was the king's scribe.
Aha. Uh-huh.
But below there, anyone who could actually read and write is in a very privileged position because society really needs them.
Right. Just the time-consuming nature of writing. I mean, even if you could write, I mean, it's not like, oh, let me scribble something down or quick shoot off an email. You know, just think of how long it just takes to write a tablet, it's just in general.
Yes. I want to write a letter of complaint to my noisy neighbor that I have to get a scribe. That's so much work.
Just like, you know, you think of like, you know, the 50s and 60s, I mean, they would have a typewriter, you know, and the executive would say, take a message. Maybe the guy could write, he would type, but phew, you know, that's going to take his whole day.
Oh, yes. It seems that really nobody in the pyramid above this level, except the Umanu, could read and write, which means that everybody above this level had to have scribes. So scribes were everywhere, and they were really important.
I think the read and writing thing I've been just, you know, reading more about too, I'm pretty sure it's like, not everybody. Some people could probably sort of get by with reading, and you didn't really write because of all the symbols. So the average person, not the average per every person, but say somebody in the court that had some education could, you know, get the basics, but they would sort of write like a baby. Then a scribe could like really put together, you know, the right way.
One big thing you have to think about in the Assyrian Empire is that there is no education. Mm-hmm. Only the scribes have education.
Yeah.
Because it's all super conservative. So most people that get a position above this and below this inherit it.
Hmm.
So they learn their position by apprenticeship to probably their father.
Yeah, they don't have an actual school.
So there is no formal education. There are no schools, no nothing. You just learn on the job by watching someone in your mentor, which is probably your dad.
Yeah.
And of course, you could, through patronage, get a position with an uncle, a family friend or something that my son would make a good...
You would think you would have to, because a lot of people mustn't have had dads just for various reasons, you know, like...
Or the dad had 10 sons. And or a dad had 10 sons and sent them out to his friends. God, I can't deal with all these sons.
But I mean, we remember we heard about Ashurbanipal arguing with his brother and how he read and write really well, but they were all taking classes together, and then the sister didn't practice her writing. So they must have had some education at least in the royal family and then in the court, just rudimentary. And I don't know. I just believe that the scribes were just really a level ahead, and they were the record keepers, and and it's not easy to write this stuff. I mean, you know, just imagine, and if you were just writing letters, everybody's handwriting would be different, but a scribe would have good handwriting. Well, these aren't letters. This is hard stuff.
Yeah.
Any hoots.
But this system is, of course, extremely vulnerable, because if you have an important position, and maybe you have no son, maybe your son is too young. So most offices that we have talked about now have a second in command, a Fanu, which is sort of the reserve guy.
Fantastic.
And this could very well be a son, but there had to be one. And this would probably be the first person considered to be a replacement, then maybe your son would replace him, etc. But you always had to have a backup guy for most offices.
They really had this thing put together.
Yes, they have been thinking about this for a long time.
Yeah. In my opinion, it's because you know how we always say they were traders, they're like businessmen. They really did run it like a bit how you would run a business.
Oh, yes.
You know, you must have had meetings and said, listen, we need another level to take care of this and that, and provinces are getting farther apart.
The Assyrians themselves never talk about this as a pyramid. But they do have a lot of offices, and they are very aware of their status. We do have, at this point, a huge mess of positions and offices that I will not go into detail of, but we'll find the eunuchs at about this level, the important eunuchs that are not chief eunuchs. But the Assyrians, they knew extremely well what the status of someone was, because they had uniforms, badges, standards, bodyguards, chariots. They had a lot of status symbols.
Yes.
And when you assumed your office, you almost all the time swore an oath of loyalty directly to the king.
Yeah. With horrible curses involved if you were to, you know, not go by them. And then they would make sure the curses came true if you did, you know, not follow your oath. Pretty strict, weren't they?
Oh, yes. We've seen what happens to people who break their oath.
Yeah.
Maggots will arrive and eat you, and meteors will strike you.
Horrible.
And, of course, you will be mutilated.
Mutilated, and, you know, your children will grind your bones into dust and all kind of horrible things.
There's one more level we have to talk about, which is almost the bottom.
All right.
The Sabi.
All right, what do they do?
That's an interesting word, because it can be translated both as soldiers or laborers, because the Assyrians made no distinction between that. So if you were the unskilled mass, the working class, you were both a soldier and a laborer, depending on what needed to be done.
Yes. I was just reading some on that also. And so, yeah, a regular foot soldier would be a soldier or a laborer. And so those guys from what I understand, wouldn't necessarily be part of the standing army, so they didn't have to pay them all the time. We're like your chariot guys and those, you know, those horse people, you know, getting the horses and even the cavalry. They were your standing paid army. But if you kept, you know, your gigantic army constantly under arms and you had to pay them, that wasn't good. So then these were your soldiers and laborers. And that's why they were that crew, whatever you needed. You know, that was like your consignment. Conscription.
Yes, the big mass of people you could work with.
Right, very interesting. Amazing, really.
And also remember that we have no currency in Assyria. There are no coins.
Yeah.
So, how were all these people paid?
Yeah.
So basically, the central court, the central government, or the provincial government paid people. And the payment were basically in the form of land, sometimes, but mostly food and clothing.
Mm-hmm.
Like the stuff you needed for basic life.
And I imagine good clothing depending on your status, right?
Yes, definitely. Declaring
right
very clearly your status.
Right, and then that's how you'd be paid. So it's, you know, what's also interesting is, did you know that when they, so if the king invited you to dinner, one of the, you know, not a commoner, one of these people, depending on your status or how much he wanted to impress you or whatever, it would depend on the dinnerware. So if you were like super important, there'd be gold, you know, and next silver, I believe bronze, ceramic, you know, down the line. So they'd be a dinner, and then you would have all that. And maybe that's kind of where the chief cupbearer comes in, too, because those cups, you know, there'd be gold cups, silver cups, bronze cups.
Yep.
They're very much about, you know, showing your status.
The king could sometimes add special rewards. And the examples we have that the king could grant you clothing.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Imagine that would be very fancy clothing.
Yeah.
He could also give you jewelry. He could give you tax exemptions. Or you could get the privilege of getting to live in the palace for the rest of your life.
Huh.
We do have a lot of letters from the 7th century. And one common theme from almost all officials is that they are complaining about being underpaid. And it seems to be accepted practice that all the officials would augment their income by taking bribes.
Yeah.
Doing a little extra taxing and stuff like that. But inefficiency and corruption were severely punished.
Yeah.
There were mutilations and executions of bad officials. So people were kind of willing to do their best to do their job.
Mm-hmm. It's like a balance. Like, don't try to take too much, but it's also a good excuse if we need to get rid of you. Well, you were, you know, you did a bribe. We're going to take, you know, kill you.
But that would probably have to go through the justice system, which we'll go back to later, because this is not chaos. There is a strict justice system, and it's fairly interesting, but we'll not talk about that now.
No, right. That's like in China was like that, because even in Confucianism, it's like they say it's better to, I believe, and please if I'm wrong, but I believe, you know, in general, it's a better to take the bribe if it's good for your family, even if it's against the king. And the Chinese officials, I know, were notoriously underpaid, and so just bribery was just part of the system, but it was also illegal.
I think that's exactly the case here, that it is illegal,
yeah,
but it is a necessary part of the system.
Yes. Kind of like the Eastern way, you know, that's probably in the Western too, but it's not necessarily baked in as the same way.
In all the administration of Assyria, there were basically two major units of the nation. The Assyrian heartland and Greater Assyria.
Okay.
And this is confusing because the term Land of Asher means either both these territories or only the heartland.
Uh-huh.
But if the Assyrians say the land, they only mean the heartland.
Okay.
And the heartland is basically a triangle with its apex at the city Asher.
Yeah.
On the Tigris, with the base stretching from Arba'il in the east to Nineveh in the west. And there were four major cities: Asher, Arba'il, Nineveh, and Kala.
Right.
And this was also pretty fertile agricultural land.
Yeah, that's up in like north Iraq. Right up against the mountains then. Butts against the mountains there. And then, you know, Mediterranean climate, as we said.
And I think this is what makes the governor of the heartland the most important governor, because this is where all the food comes from, or most of the food at least.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the central government's just there too, of course.
And remember, they're very conservative and the king can give special rewards. And over these perhaps 1,000 years, king had given a lot of privileges to the cities.
Yeah.
So the cities were in a very special place and they jealously guarded this.
Right.
And the situation was worst in Asher. That's why the king decided to leave Asher.
Right. It was
It was also another special position was to be the governor of Asher, of the city. He did not report to anyone else but the king.
Yes.
And didn't take any orders from anyone else but the king.
So that was definitely, and he was most likely a eunuch too most of the time.
Or perhaps a powerful noble, because this is where the powerful noble families love to hang out in Asher, because that's where they have all their privileges.
Yes. They made it sort of a ceremonial city eventually. You know, when you think about it, because the capital was in Nineveh, so then Asher is good. Okay, you guys could be big shots in Asher, you know, and be traditionalists or whatever, but, you know, king could still get away with his other stuff in the other towns.
Yes.
I mean, in Nineveh. Yeah.
And then we talk about the king moving the capital to another city, but the term capital, which we have used a lot of times in this podcast, is a bit misleading because
right,
it's not like a modern capital. It's the administrative headquarter, pretty much. So where the king is, the administration headquarter is. And if the king goes to Nineveh, then Nineveh becomes this place that is extra important. But Asher is still the ancient city of Asher, the city of the god Asher. It's still the most important city in a sense.
Mm-hmm. In the name of this country.
I just noted that I missed an important position.
Who is it?
In the pyramid. A lot of positions, actually. We do have the priests.
Oh, sure. Sure, of course. I mean, you know, he talked about the government.
They're also kind of in a special pyramid of their own.
Yes, that's what I was going to say.
and controlled directly by the king, who is the chief priest of the chief god.
Right. That's what makes you an Assyrian, by being a worshipper of Asher.
Yes, but each temple is its special administrative unit. And they have their own structure. And maybe we should save that for religion.
All these other things, like we said, you were saying, you know, you got to move troops around, you got to collect taxes. These are official, you know, duties of a government to run a government. But because religion and government were so intertwined, being an official of religion was important. And the actual physical thing they had to do was to bring food, right? They had to bring food to all the temples in the provinces and feed the god. And you took a part of the ceremony too. So after they gave the food to the god, they even had this like mouth opening ceremony supposedly, and the god became sentient and they play music and they give him this, you know, his food. And then what was left, I don't know how he actually ate it, then the people would eat it. And it was ceremonial because a lot of it was rotten probably. It wasn't good anymore, but that's what made you, you know, an Assyrian by taking part in the eating with the god. And then, so you had to get the food from Asher all around the empire. So that's the administrative tasks of these, you know, temple pyramids. It's like a physical job you had to do.
Yeah, we must also remember that in addition to being super conservative, the Assyrians are also extremely superstitious, mm-hmm. which we will see again in the legal system.
Yeah, and everybody in ancient times were so superstitious like this. It was such a cause and effect. And just, in my opinion, I think that the gods were kind of like airheads in a way, you know? It was like you just had to give them their food and do their things for them, or they'll like send a flood, or they'll do something horrible. So just kiss their asses, do what you got to do. It's sort of that's why it's so much ritual.
Yes. And the biggest difference, we said it before, the biggest difference to modern religion or to Christianity or Islam is that it doesn't matter really what you believe. It matters what you do. The rituals are all important.
Exactly.
There is another position in the empire that is sort of outside of the pyramid. And there is a standing order to all officials in the system. And this standing order is amazing, because this is the duty of all officials in the empire.
Let's have.
And the order is, you must report to the king whatever you see and hear.
Yeah.
Which is, of course, impossible. But there is a group of guys who will help you with this. They are the messengers.
Ah.
And we know the empire has, in the 7th century at least, a network of military roads and posting stations. So you have messengers traveling everywhere. This is the postal system that Tiglath-Pileser III invented.
Yep.
And we also have fire signals to convey messages.
Oh, right.
Especially in the border regions.
Yeah.
Yes. So communication is pretty swift in the empire.
Yeah, it needed to be. Just so much going on. We're on the edges and in it, and, you know, you could lose it quick if some army comes coming through or some, you know, things like that. They definitely was important. And they used mules, right? You guys covered that before I was in the podcast, I believe, but I believe it was mule teams that were on the postal routes. Not like a horses, you know, you think of the Pony Express and horses, but they use mules because they were better, you know, to go through desert and, you know, you didn't need them for the war necessarily. And they would use like a 2-mule team. And then they, like you said, they had the relay stations and they could get stuff pretty far from, you know, a long distance by using those relay systems.
Huh.
And how about the envelopes too? You know, remember how they would put a letter. And they would, so, you know, they actually had envelopes. They would, you know, have the tablet, and then they would put another clay around it. And then the king or whoever is supposed to get it, then you break it, and you knew that nobody else saw it.
Pretty clever.
Right? I mean, telling you, these guys set the foundation for empire in the, you know, the Near East for the rest of the, you know, as a history, pretty much. Like you said, we can go by what the court was in Istanbul. I almost said Constantinople. Just like there, you know, that's how they... But these are the guys who started it.
Oh, yes.
Because they were very organized.
And I want to talk about Plato.
Who?
Plato.
Plato?
The Greek philosopher.
Oh, well, let's hear.
In one of his works, he defined the ideal form of government is the enlightened monarch.
Mm.
And he thought that this was the best way to run any state. And mm-hmm. this is very much an autocracy with
right.
one all-powerful individual at the top. And as long as this person is competent, such right. as perhaps Ashurnasirpal II or Sargon,
yeah,
it works.
Mm-hmm.
Its decisions can be made quickly and propagate down the system, and stuff gets done. But the weakness, of course, is when the king gets old.
Right.
Like Shalmaneser III did at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Or that we will see very soon when we continue the narrative. Then the burden falls on the system. Because if the king doesn't control it, these other guys must make the decisions. And it's not like Nazi Germany, where Hitler intentionally built a system so that it would collapse without him.
Yeah.
Two different officials had the same job, pretty much, in.
Right.
And were hostile to each other, in a sense. But here, the system is kind of built to handle a bad monarch, and it did survive weak monarchs several times.
Yeah, that's a good point. There's a lot of Varuses, you know, like Varus the eunuch, who knew what was going on, and they just kept running things.
But in the end, this will perhaps prove the undoing. We'll analyze the fall of the empire a lot in upcoming episodes.
A monarchy will always prove the undoing of anything because it's always a roll of the dice. Dan Carlin said in one of his episodes, actually on the World War I, about Kaiser Wilhelm, you know? Like if Kaiser Wilhelm wasn't the ruler of Germany, there might not have been a World War I because he wasn't a complete moron, but he was not a, you know... He would have never got elected to that job.
That raises a very good question. So, what else works? And do we really know? Capitalism and democracy is still extremely new things.
Absolutely. And we're looking in the world today, which is appropriate. We're seeing autocratic tendencies.
We saw what democracy led to in the 20th century in some nations.
Right. I remember Hitler saying himself, like, look at these still silly laws, and they, you know, there's 9 political parties, and nobody can get anything done. You need me. It sounds familiar. And what we've been hearing in our country and some other places. And sure, an enlightened monarch is the best, but you just can't, if you could program one, you know, if it was an AI, sure, that's guaranteed to be enlightened, but how do you guarantee enlightenment?
Yesterday, there was a vote of no confidence for the Swedish prime minister, and he got fired. We have 8 parties. They cannot cooperate. And after the last election in Sweden, it took 4 months to form a government. And I know this is very similar to the situation in the Netherlands and in Israel. And now we really don't know. We have an upcoming election in 2022, but now we might get into a forced election, an extra election, which might make things clearer, but it's super confusing. And anyone from, for example, the United States would probably think that all our 8 parties are super similar. They would be about where Bernie Sanders
right.
is on your
yeah.
political right-left scale. All of them. But they do feel that they are very different from each other. And now it's political chaos here.
But it's working. So that shows that you're in the institutions are, you know, it's not like people are murdering each other on the streets, right?
Not yet.
I mean, you know, it sounds, if you say to Americans that It just sounds funny, like, well, there's no government now. Like, what does that mean? There's no government. Does that mean, you know, people murdering each other in the streets? But no, laws are still there. You still have institutions, you still have administration.
Back to Assyria.
Back to Assyria. They didn't do it. They would have thought you're insane to do it that way. Let us mutilate the other eight parties and we're good.
So what I talked a lot about their super conservatism, but at times of great stress and strains to the empire, they did flexible things. And that is one reason why the state survived such a long time. But because there were other mechanisms, except for this power structure, the pyramid. We had families and tribal affiliations.
Right.
And it must be stressed that social advancement, in the sense you can get it in the United States, at least that's what you say, it didn't really exist. One single individual had a very hard time to advance in the system based purely on merit, yeah. But a family could over the long run.
Yeah, and they could people maybe thought more that way. You know, you're not so individualistic in a time like this. These times where, you know, you would think for your family and, you know, move up your family, that kind of thing. Yeah, because you could say, you know, if you got deported from your place and moved into the cities and you were from a good family, there's a good chance to advance that way. Or become a eunuch was actually, you know, a family could make you, but you really couldn't help your family because you became part of the king's family when you were a eunuch. But it was still, it must have reflected well in some way on your family if you're, you know, you're, one of your sons was a eunuch that was the Turtano.
We do also have how you addressed another person. We have this from letters, and it's probably what they did when they talked to each other. So if you were talking to someone above you,
okay,
you would address them as my lord, Belly.
Belly.
And if you refer to yourself, you would call yourself Uradka, which means your servant.
Ah.
But if you're talking to...
Your servant says XYZ.
Exactly. And if you're talking to a social equal, based on the position in the pyramid, and sometimes based as well on family, you would address them as my brother.
Oh, okay, just like the old king letters and, you know, the Bronze Age and stuff. My brother, I see.
But if you're talking to someone way above you, for example, if you're talking to the king,
yeah,
you would not call yourself your servant. Or you would go to lengths to call yourself even worse things. We have a letter where somebody refers to himself as a simple dog in the king's service.
Groveling. Talk about groveling.
If you like this conversation, you can go to Patreon and support the podcast. Because we do need your help to stay around. We've been around for a long time, yeah. And we want to be around for a lot longer. You can find us on patreon.com. And search for Fan of History. It's a mutual agreement in that if we don't produce episodes, you don't pay anything. So if we would, for any reason, miss an episode, you don't pay anything.
Right.
Yes. Thanks to everyone who has supported us.
I hope you think it's worth it. I love when listeners reach out, so please do.
Reach out to us.
Please.
Thank you, Bernie. Speak to you next time.
Thank you, Dan. Yep, talk to you again, Dan.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us on Patreon. Patreon.com/fanofhistory.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Just a dollar an episode would help us out. Thanks, and see you next time.